This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book looking at the role of motherhood in society, who says it serves as a form of undervalued labor. Now, federal waivers allowing all schools to participate in universal free school meal programs came to an end on June 30th. The waivers, which gave free meals to any K-12 student in a participating school during summer and the academic year, began as an emergency response to COVID-19. Advocates for the program are fighting for legislation to keep it going, especially as some families report they're left with uncertainty about the best way to manage finances and food as the school year approaches. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent who benefited from these federal waivers? Did your school use this program to say, hey, anybody who wants a meal gets a meal, no need to provide proof of low income? Do you want it to continue, or do you think it was an emergency measure and the main emergency has passed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Erin Gretzinger is a reporting intern for Wisconsin Watch. She recently co-wrote an article with Maddie Bergstrom for Wisconsin Watch on universal school meals. Erin, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's going to look different for parents and kids in this fall's back to school when it comes to the availability of these lunches?
Right. So all Wisconsin schools operating federal food service programs offered free meals through the seamless summer option through the 2021-2022 school year. And many schools in the 2020-2021 school year also offered free meals through a federal waiver. So many schools in Wisconsin for the first time in 2 years won't have that option since that waiver has now expired and legislative efforts to replace or reinstate it have stalled. This is going to have a really big impact on students, families, and schools themselves. We know that keeping kids fed has an impact on their performance in school. School meals are linked to more children eating at school, kids being less likely to skip breakfast, and also improve in school attendance. And additionally, without the application process last fall, families didn't have to apply for free school meals, and it was treated like anything else, a part of the school day, which helped alleviate stigma. And free meals allowed families typically on the fringe of qualifying for meals or otherwise financially struggling families to receive these meals. And we saw in Wisconsin that this contributed to a boost in participation in school meals, and particularly in breakfast, which is a huge feat for the state, since we're normally one of the worst ranking states in terms of breakfast participation. And like I said, schools also benefit from universal free meals since it decreased some administrative burdens in administering the meals since students got them like anything else a part of the school day. So overall, there's going to be a lot of changes without that this fall, since families will once again have to qualify, and we'll see some of those benefits of this school meal experiment fade away.
And your article highlights one Wisconsin woman's story about her experience with food insecurity after being furloughed, a common experience at the outset of COVID. Can you share some of her story?
Yeah, absolutely. So the family that we feature in the story is from Waukesha, which was actually the only school district in Wisconsin to initially opt out of the free meals program in the 2021-2022 school year. The family that we featured in the story, they had faced layoffs and income shocks, a situation we know that many people in Wisconsin went through, especially at the start of the pandemic. And this shows in food insecurity numbers themselves. Feeding America's numbers from Wisconsin show that 40% of people who use food pantries during the pandemic were using them for the first time. So the situation the Goodmans were facing, the family we highlighted, was something we can see was a common theme throughout Wisconsin and the country. So the Goodmans, they used any assistance they could use, including free school meals. And what they found is that lunch money really added up to make a big difference. And this family, particularly without the free meal program this fall, they're worried about paying for food amid record high inflation. And other families will be grappling with that as well across Wisconsin.
Talking to Erin Gretzinger with Wisconsin Watch, looking at changes in school nutrition programs. Many schools that were able to provide free school meals to all students without proof of low income. That program's expired, so it'll look different in many schools this fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your experiences Whether you work at a school, you send your kids to school, you go to school as a student yourself. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Aaron, in your reporting, what have you heard from Wisconsin schools with this change looming next month?
Yeah, absolutely. So we heard just from talking to the Department of Public Instruction that they received a lot of reports from schools about how free meals really made a difference in their ability to reach students because it eased this administrative process. Schools didn't have to keep track of which students had money in their account or if they qualified for free and reduced meals. It also addressed the issue of school meal debt, and an estimated 3/4 of schools across the country report school meal debt, which cuts into their own budgets and abilities to provide food service programs. Another big thing we heard from schools was that this curbed a practice known as lunch shaming. And one way in which this manifests is how that schools give students alternative meals, such as cheese sandwiches, when the money in their school meal account runs out. And this can subject students to stigma because if you see a kid in the lunch line with a cheese sandwich, it immediately points them out as not being able to afford that school meal. So we see the support from schools also manifesting in the Healthy School Meals for All campaign, which was launched in coordination with legislation proposed in Wisconsin last fall that never made it out of committee, but would have provided additional state reimbursements in addition to federal reimbursements. So to incentivize schools in Wisconsin to provide free meals. And this coalition has several school districts signed on, as well as 50 supporters overall.
Now, you mentioned there was some controversy in the Waukesha School District when they didn't want to pick this up. There has been opposition to this, saying too much federal control over these programs. And of course, now that students are in school, the at-home learning has ended, the need for this program isn't there. Can you talk about the other side of this a little bit, why people are ready, some people are ready to see this expire?
Yeah, I think Waukesha is a really interesting case, and it actually became kind of the epicenter of this debate over universal free meals in the nation. Like I said, Waukesha was the only district in Wisconsin to initially opt out of the free meal program in 2021-2022 school year. And this decision received national attention after it was picked up by the Washington Post. One school board member we talked to said he received over 500 emails over the incident. And it led to, rallies in the community, and it received media inquiries from all over the world, including Moscow. And just in general, the opposition surrounding this is kind of, as you alluded to, that potentially this was a federal emergency provision. We also heard concerns specifically from school members that, or school board members, when this became a heated debate, that this was a program that would be used to feed all children, even those who didn't need the free meal program. Like, for example, if you could afford to pay for free meals, why would you accept the free meals? And that was one point of debate. And then another issue too is just how this became politicized in Waukesha. And there was also comparisons to other debates about CRT and other issues that were predominant on school boards across the country during the pandemic.
And Aaron, what are you watching for next on this school meal story?
Yeah, so like I said, in the fall, schools will once again be subject to free and reduced lunch applications. So it'll be a process for schools to get those applications back out to families, to be alerting them of this change, as this has been the system for 2 years. So seeing how that rollout goes out and making sure that families understand the application process more generally. As I mentioned earlier, there is legislation in Wisconsin called the Healthy School Meals for All Act, which was authored by 30 Democrats in the Wisconsin legislature. And that seems to still be on the table and getting some momentum potentially into this fall. So keeping an eye on that bill and seeing if free meals does become a reality in Wisconsin.
Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
That was Aaron Gretzinger, reporting intern at Wisconsin Watch, with us today to talk about her reporting on the end of a universal free school meal program that's federally funded and how it'll affect Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll talk to a researcher who looks at the impact of providing meals in schools, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's a good idea to offer free meals to all students, or should it be need-based? Should it be something that's available to every district or just ones with a lot of need? What questions do you have about the impact of all this? What experiences do you have to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. As we just heard, federal waivers that allowed universal free school meals for all students are coming to an end. Our next guest has researched the impact of expanded school nutrition programs on learning and discipline in schools. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want free meals available in more schools to all students, or should it just be need-based as it was in many places before the pandemic? Has this all affected your life one way or another? You're a student at school, you're a parent of said student, you're a teacher, a school staffer. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Krista Ruffini is an assistant professor at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, researching how government policies affect the labor market, education, and health outcomes. Krista, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, this change hasn't happened yet, so it's maybe hard to study the impact, but you've done some before and after studies looking at the impact of providing meals to all students. What kind of things have you learned from the past?
Yeah, that's right. So I've done a whole host of research that has evaluated an earlier form of school-wide free meals called the community eligibility provision. So under the community eligibility provision, schools and districts in which there's already a large share of students that are receiving free meals because they're eligible to receive other forms of income assistance, these schools and districts can just offer school-wide free meals to all of the students. And so there's a lot of variation in when schools and districts decided to start this program. Part of this is due to the federal legislation and when states were eligible. And then as the program has developed, more and more states have, or schools and districts have opted in. And so I've looked at the effect of this program on academic achievement, on student discipline, and on the use of community food resources, namely food banks. And what I find is really some meaningful benefits across the board. So we see improvements in math performance, especially for Hispanic and white students. I see reductions in out-of-school suspensions, especially for younger white male students. And there's also reductions in food bank usage. And importantly, all of these benefits are going to be concentrated in the schools and districts in which there weren't that many kids that were receiving free meals before the universal provision became an option.
And something I should clarify for my own benefit, because I kind of, my head's spinning a little bit, with the changes, even after this universal thing goes away, that community program where schools with high levels of students who are eligible for free and reduced lunches can provide lunches to everybody, they, correct me if I'm wrong, still get to keep doing that, right?
Yeah, 100% correct. So there's, even though the federal kind of universal waiver of universal meals has expired, there's still a bunch of options that schools and districts have for those areas that are interested in continuing some form of universal school meals. So community eligibility provision is one. Provision two is another, but importantly, all of these pre-existing programs are only available to areas that are kind of high poverty to begin with.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jill is with us in Kimberly. Jill, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jill?
Well, I want to speak as a kindergarten teacher and as a parent. I know that it's a lot easier to have free lunch for everybody. We have seen in the past that even some families that qualify for free and reduced lunches don't do the paperwork, or you know how life gets busy and you get behind things. And so they let their lunch account get behind or fall into the negative. And it's embarrassing for students to like try to go through the lunch line and not be able to because they're so far negative. And as a parent, for me to not have to worry about topping up their lunch account was really nice. So I really appreciated that last year it was free and reduced. Nobody had to worry about it. Everybody got healthy food. it was just a lot easier and good for the kids.
And Jill, as a on the teacher side of your resume here, do you notice, you know, if kids are getting these meals, does it make it easier to teach them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just a lot easier if they aren't hungry, or with the free meals, they were also able to get breakfast last year. And that made a huge difference as well. We had more kids coming and getting breakfast and starting the day fed instead of hungry. So it was a huge benefit.
Jill, thanks for the call. Krista, your thoughts on Jill's experience?
Yeah, I think, Jill, you raise a whole bunch of really important points. And in addition to not filling out paperwork, I know, you know, when I was a child, I didn't bring my parents every piece of paper that was handed to me. But there's also kind of the eligibility only extends so far up the income distribution. So in order to be eligible for free meals, a single parent with two kids can't make more than about $30,000 a year. So that means a full-time, full-year worker earning $15 an hour isn't going to qualify for the free program. So there's a lot of families that are relatively low income but don't qualify on paper.
Jill, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Krista Ruffini from Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, looking at universal availability of free meals for students, breakfast and lunch. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Krista, people might say, okay, yeah, meals are good for kids, no doubt about it, but schools have a lot of financial needs. Is this the best way to do this, given that at least some of this is providing meals for students whose families can afford to feed them?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think you raised kind of two points here. So one is that schools have a lot of costs that they have to deal with. And we heard from Aaron's reporting earlier that in many cases, just making meals available to everyone without a cost actually was cost savings in some respects. They didn't need to monitor all that paperwork and go through those administrative hurdles. Now, at the end of the day, it's still going to cost the money. And so schools and districts across the state and across the country need to ask, are the costs associated with giving the higher income kids the free meals who might not need one, are those costs greater than the cost to the other kids who wouldn't be receiving a meal but could benefit? And so there's kind of different costs and benefits that we need to weigh when we're thinking about whether we should expand this program.
Thanks for the call. Go now to Heidi in Merton. Heidi, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Heidi?
Well, I kind of find it, I'm a teacher, a former parent, my kids are out of the house now, but I find it kind of two-sided here. Here they don't want to pay for the kids' lunches, and they, you know, don't want to continue this program, but yet they're willing to take money away from the public schools for those students that want to go to private schools, and they want to pay for that. To me, that seems like a double-edged sword.
Heidi, thanks for the call. Krista, what do you think?
I have done no research on school privatization, so I don't want to speak outside of my area of expertise, but I agree that there is a lot of movement in education policy kind of across the board.
Heidi, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us now in Madison. Tom, hello. Are you there, Tom?
I've worked as an artist in residence in many different states, and I just see this as a no-brainer. I think when you get people who oppose it, like the people in Waukesha, they are people that are putting their political identity ahead of the children's welfare and general health. I think too many times these days, a conservative is somebody who stays awake all night thinking that, wow, somebody might be getting something they don't deserve.
Tom, thanks for the call. Chris, I'm guessing from what you just said, you don't want to go outside into the world of the politics of this. But what are you seeing when it comes to whether states are trying to step in and replace what the federal government had just done?
Yeah, and I think Tom brings up an important point in that this program and making it universal has a lot of support from a lot of people. And we've seen some states either introduce, Wisconsin being one of them, legislation to continue this program on a statewide basis. And others like Massachusetts, Vermont, California have already extended it statewide. And so we see like universal programs tend to be popular. And there's good reason for that.
Thanks for the call. Heather joins us now in Madison. Heather, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm a professional educator, and I was curious because if the students have participated in free breakfast programs, and there are free lunch or reduced programs as well, and there is a little bit of an increase in some of the churches in the local area communities providing like after-school meals or other after-school programs. But I do have a question. There is a kind of a national No Kid Hungry campaign that's been successful, both financially, but it's definitely in California. And as not just a contributor of the past, but talking with some other people in the state of California, most of those funds stay in the state of California just because of the size and the need. And as a person involved in different events or activities and professionals or as profession in the culinary industry as well, I've got a, is there an equivalent for the state of
Heather, I gotcha. We're just about out of time. Krista, briefly, have you seen this California thing? Are there equivalents to it elsewhere?
Yeah, I would say there's a wide array of community and local resources that really are very unique to each community and are really working very hard and doing great work to address the needs in where they're operating.
Heather, thanks for the call. And Krista, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Been talking to Krista Ruffini, an assistant professor at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. Krista joined us today to talk about the impact that the end of universal free school meals could have on learning and discipline in schools. A little while ago, we heard from Wisconsin Watch and reporting on this issue. They have a resource where people can text WISFood, W-I-S food, to 73224 to connect directly with a reporter who can answer food-related questions and help people find food resources. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, from warehouses and coffee shops to railroads and delivery companies, unions have been in the spotlight a lot this year. Get the latest on the labor movement and join in with your own experiences, maybe your questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Regular listeners may know that I'm a big fan of a group of brown bears in Alaska, which seems random. It is kind of random, but hear me out. These are the bears at Katmai National Park in Alaska. They have an annual fattest bear competition. The bears don't. People do online. There's a set of amazing web cameras where you can watch the bears at a waterfall catching salmon. I'm hooked. I'm telling everybody about this. So that's why I'm excited about the show. Tomorrow, we're going to have one of the rangers from Katmai on the show to tell us about the brown bears, the salmon, the falls, the webcams, the whole deal. If you want to get a head start, search for Brown Bear Camera Brooks Falls and start watching, then learn more tomorrow on the show. It's nature news you can use. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, after a year of record-breaking coastal floods, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says more places will be hit more often. Jen White looks at what the science says about ice melt and sea level rise today at 6 on 1A+. Now, anybody who's raised a kid will tell you parenting can be hard work, but we don't always think of nurturing our children as the same kind of hard work as going to a job. Raising our own kids doesn't earn us a paycheck, and it doesn't always carry the same value in society as a job outside the home. Our next guest says mothering in particular is undervalued, and she writes, quote, "We must start by acknowledging mothering as highly skilled work that deserves respect and compensation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like parenting, mothering in particular, is undervalued in some way? Have you ever added up the value of all the different tasks you do while raising a kid and wondering, what does a job like that pay if we put a dollar value on it? Did the pandemic change the experience of parenting, especially for the moms out there? Was it more isolated? Did you feel like on your own even more maybe than you had been before? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Angela Garbez is a writer and author of the book Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
It's kind of this weird paradox. I think we put a lot of cultural and symbolic value on mothering, but not a lot of, I guess, practical and financial value on it. Make the case for rethinking and changing that a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, cultural and symbolic value doesn't really get you a lot in the real world. I would say, here's the case. We're both adults, and we didn't make it here on our own. Somebody gave birth to you. Somebody took care of you through the helplessness of infancy. Someone made sure you got to school on time. Someone helped you read. Someone taught you how to bathe yourself, clean yourself, and did that for you before you could do it. And that care that we give babies, even though they've done nothing to earn it, really, except be born, why do we not value that as people get older, right? No one makes it through life without being cared for and mothered. And that doesn't always just happen from a parent. It happens from a beloved teacher. It happens from a grandmother, an auntie, chosen family, mentors. And really, this basic care work, mothering is really tending to our physical and basic emotional needs. It's the work that makes all other work possible. If you didn't know how to feed and dress yourself, if you didn't have a roof over your head, you wouldn't be able to go out and do other things in the world, you know, professional work. But I really believe that caring for ourselves and caring for our people is the only real work humans have to do. And it's about time we start talking about it as essential labor.
Yeah, you put it in the context of the, you know, American economy, the global economy. We think of productivity as, you know, the jobs we're making stuff, selling it to each other and that sort of thing. You use the phrase, and others do, reproductive labor. Without the labor that goes into raising kids, none of that other stuff can happen. It's kind of like the there's this big, you know, under the iceberg, to use the cliche, that we're not seeing.
Yeah, no, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah, one thing that American capitalism has never fully dealt with is that we rely just as much on domestic labor, which happens in the home and is expected for free from mothers or for very low wages for domestic, professional domestic and care workers. The economy doesn't run without it. And we really saw this in the pandemic when childcare centers closed, when nannies and babysitters couldn't come to our homes. We were all lost. And people found that it was very difficult to do professional work and to do domestic work and care at the same time. It's more than one person can do.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Deb is with us in Waukesha. Deb, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Deb?
This is such an important topic. I will share that I am 63 years old, and it has just dawned on me in the last couple years that I should have been receiving a paycheck from the family budget for being a stay-at-home mom. And I believe that without that, we lose our sense of a sense of power and a sense of value that is needed, especially at that time when we're staying home watching the children. And if we had to go out and do those services, as you're hearing from the other callers, it would be so expensive and so valuable. And I think every stay-at-home mom needs to be paid for what they're doing.
Deb, thanks for the call. Angela, what do you think?
I think everyone should listen to Deb. Right on, Deb. I think that we should reframe it. So, yeah, you can say, you know, in America we say, oh, she's just a stay-at-home mom, or I'm just a stay-at-home mom. But how about I'm the CEO of my household? I'm the chief executive officer of household logistics, right? I am the household manager. We really need to reframe this. Like, she's exactly right. Like, these skills of, you know, oh, there's so much creativity involved. There's so much thinking on the fly. There's so much multitasking and so much management. You know, out in the professional world, we pay higher wages for that. But in the home, because it's private and because we like to think of it as quote unquote women's work, we think it should be done for free. But no, this is something that I thought about a lot in the pandemic, which was a lot of the seed for this book, which is that at the very beginning of the pandemic, when I was home 24/7 with my children for 4 months straight, and I knew that was the most important job I could be doing, keeping them safe and keeping my community safe and healthy. And I was hearing about how, you know, we were talking about essential laborers, healthcare workers, the doctors and nurses who were treating us, you know, sanitation workers, teachers, and all of those people are yes, essential to our society. And then I thought, what about us? What about parents? What about mothers? Because I'm working all the time and it feels pretty darn essential.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking Angela Garbez, author of the new book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Angela, you mentioned workers who do a lot of the jobs that we associate kind of in the mothering job description, house cleaners, childcare providers, and others often being paid very low. Often, you write, these jobs being done by women of color in particular. Can you talk about your hopes for them as well?
Sure. So I think, you know, as long as we're reckoning with some of the things in America that we've never fully reckoned with, the reason why we are comfortable paying women of color, and the majority of people doing this work are Black and brown women, and the majority of them are mothers themselves. So the reason why I believe we are willing to pay them less or expect this work for very, like, you know, poor wages is because of the history of slavery in America. The home has always been a site of work for Black women in this country. And when, you know, feminism in the 1960s told everyone, Betty Friedan said, you know, find meaning outside of the home, that's great. But we never got rid of domestic labor. And so we started hiring Black and brown women to do those wages. And domestic workers are 3 times as likely to live in poverty as any other worker in America. And that's really shameful. If we are entrusting people with what we say is the most valuable thing, the most important things in our lives, those are our children, and we can't pay them a living wage, what does that say about us as a society? You know, what does that say about us as individuals? The median wage for any worker in America is close to $20 an hour, which is already barely enough to make it. But when we look at domestic workers, that drops to a median wage of $12 an hour. And the lowest median wage in the country is for nannies. That's $11.60 an hour. So I think it's really a myth to say that this work is unskilled labor. I think that's the way we justify paying low wages. But really, all work is real work. If you've ever taken care of a child for longer than 15 minutes, you know it is not unskilled labor. You have to know how to soothe that child, how to calm them. And it's so fundamental to our existence as a society, and it's a shame that we don't value it the way that we should.
We're talking with author Angela Garbez about her latest book. It's called Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think motherhood, not as an idea, but as a set of tasks, as a work, a job in a way, gets enough recognition? Do you have an experience you'd like to share with us? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Angela Garbez. She's with us today sharing her latest book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own experiences as a mom, with your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Carol is with us in Hillsboro. Carol, hello.
Hi. I had the privilege of being a stay-at-home mom. We had 5 kids, and I had 2 that were in grade school, and then a baby, a 2-year-old, and a 4-year-old. And my husband came home from work one day and said, "What do you do around here all day?" You know, I guess the house was a mess and dishes weren't done. So I started writing down what I did every day, and then I checked it off like I actually had a list. And I threw a couple things in there that I didn't do. And then I did that for 2 weeks, and then I gave him a bill for being an accountant, a laundry person, a chef, a housekeeper, a daycare and nanny, and a personal shopper, and he couldn't afford me.
Carol, thank you for sharing that that experiment with us. Angela, what do you think?
More people should do what Carol does. And there's actually, I applaud Carol for keeping that kind of record and information, because it's a way of showing people, you know, these things that we take for granted, we can't. There's so much that goes into it. And I invite, actually, listeners, I did this, and I write about it in the book. A journalist named Amy Westervelt created something called the Invisible Labor Calculator. And if you Google this, you'll find it. And she used Bureau of Labor Statistics and data to assign value to different household jobs, you know, whether that's gardening, shopping, as Carol had mentioned, you know, nannying, childcare, and tending to the emotional and psychological needs of your family members. So you can put in what, you know, the amount of time you think you spend doing that every week, and it will calculate for you, based again on U.S. government data, what your salary would be. And so I did this at the beginning of the pandemic, and I was shocked to find out that I was so shocked, actually, that I did it twice because I didn't believe it the first time. But the Invisible Labor Calculator told me that I would be making over $300,000 a year in my job as a stay-at-home mother and caregiver. And that would be the highest-paying job I've ever had by three times, more than three times. And that's something that, you know, that's what Carol did years ago. And I think that it's really important for people to see that, to I invite people to try that and to start to begin to really think about how valuable their work is within the home. Oxfam actually did a study a couple of years ago and said that in the U.S. alone, if women were paid minimum wage for all the unpaid labor they did in the home, it would be worth $1.9 trillion.
Thanks.
And that is money that is not counted in our economy, and it should be.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Courtney joins us now in Madison. Courtney, hi.
Hi. Yeah, mine is a little off the topic of in-home care because my child's in daycare, and my husband and I are just completely appalled at the amount that we pay but how little the care workers make in daycares. And I was curious if your speaker has any thoughts on the role of government in helping to support that. And particularly, we've been discussing in our family how in Canada, they're working really hard to get $20 a day daycares, and that's supported by the government. And in BC, $10 a day daycare. So I was just curious if your speaker had any thoughts on that.
Courtney, thanks. Angela, go ahead.
Oh, Courtney, I do. I think that we all do. Parents are all overwhelmed, right? And we're stretched. And we do things to make community all the time. We take care of each other's kids. We do play dates, right? But we are not, there's a structural failing here. You know, we tend to feel like because things are happening in the home, they feel like individual failures that we have, or we feel like, how do we solve the problem of like giving our beloved caregivers more money, right? And this is really where the government needs to step in, right? We have privatized all human rights in the United States. Like, you're not guaranteed health care or housing, early childhood education, or an education, you know, as you get older. Other countries have figured this out, which is not to say that other countries are perfect, but other countries believe in valuing people and investing in people. And I don't know about you, Courtney, but I personally voted in this administration, the Biden administration, because they ran on things like care infrastructure, paid family leave. They also ran on codifying Roe v. Wade, and they've really bargained away those things. In Build Back Better, we, the Democrats, let those things slide. You know, we recently passed a new package, and all provisions to fund care
in the home and to fund early childhood education centers were, sort of let go as collateral damage to make a deal. And the people who represent us need to know that that is a failing on their part and they are not making good on promises. And at this point, we need investment from the government. Working people, working families are doing everything they can to make ends meet out here, and this is not working for us. And yes, our electeds need to hear from us, and the government needs to do more.
Thanks for the call, Courtney. Leah joins us next in Lafarge. Leah, hello.
Hi. I was going to say that when I was out of work during the pandemic, I decided to fully embrace being a stay-at-home mom and to see what that was like. And I did a lot of the same things that I did when I was working, but I had more time to do it. And what I found was that I still wasn't able to stay on top of all the mess with all the people, with it all being just one person's job. And so I felt, my husband was still working, so he's paying all the bills. I didn't necessarily feel like I needed to be paid. I just felt like I needed to be very much appreciated, because it is like that invisibleness of the work. Because if you're not having to pay all the bills, like, that's a load off of your back. But it's just in that those chores can be, done and forgotten. And then, you got to do them all over again. So I'm kind of making a case as the mom or the dad, or even better as a team, being the household manager, to enlist labor from everyone. And that's better for moms, it's better for dads, and it's better for the kids to be participating.
Leah, thanks a lot for that call. Angela, what do you think?
I think Leah is right on, for sure. I was in a similar situation where I put my work on hold because it's my husband's job who gives us a paycheck, who gives us regular health insurance. And as a freelance writer, I don't get those things. And part of why I wrote this book was born out of all of the feelings I had in being a caretaker, missing my professional work, and really feeling like acknowledgement would go a long way. I mean, I do think that we deserve wages for the work that we do, but any kind of acknowledgement and appreciation does go a long way. And one of the things that I did is I talked to my children, about this. I said to them, when I'm feeding them three meals a day and snacks and seemingly every hour, I would say to them, I do this because I love you. And I will never stop doing this. But this takes work for me to cook dinner, for me to wash your clothes, for me to take care of you. That takes energy and time. And we really need to name this stuff as work. And also to pick up on something Leah was saying, it's too much for one person to do. And that's another thing about modern American life, is that we live in nuclear families. We really prize, one mom, one dad, and 2.2 kids. And it's just not meant how we were meant to raise kids. Throughout the entire world, for centuries, we raised children communally. So, if it feels like too much to cook, 21 meals a week for your family and to do 7 loads of laundry, it's because it is too much, because we do need help from our partners, from other household members, from even our children, but also we need help from friends. We need help from an extended network. We need chosen family. And that's another thing I saw in the pandemic. People forming pods, people taking care of each other's children, having family dinners and kind of throwing their lots in together. I think that's a very human urge to want to be taken care of and to take care of others. And it's healthier and it's emotionally very wonderful. And I think we could all lean into that a little bit more as the pandemic, it's not over, but as it sort of recedes more into the rear view, I don't want us to give up that interdependence and that realization that taking care of ourselves is work and that we cannot do it entirely alone.
Just very briefly, Angela, we've just got a minute left. We haven't even touched really the second half of your book. You were hoping to make mothering a joyful experience and raise happy kids. Can you leave us with just a minute thought on that?
Yes. I mean, it's easy to focus on all the things that are hard, but I wrote this book in part as a celebration of caregiving because it is so fundamental. And when you don't have to worry about where the next paycheck coming from, when you are able to do those things in community and really be present
with your children and then be present with yourself, it can be some of the most meaningful, joyful work. You know, when I get down, I don't really like imaginative play, but when I get down on all fours and meow like a cat with my three-year-old, I mean, it brings something to my life that I can't quantify. And it is also realizing that I can teach my children joy. I can show them that they are valuable just as they are. They don't need to go have a job to contribute something to the world. And that's really what mothering is day in and day out. It's insisting on our value and our worth, and that will serve children for years to come.
Angela, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob, and thank you to all your wonderful callers.
That's Angela Garbez, writer and author of the book Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll review today's primary election results and then set the stage for the next 3 months and the run-up to the statewide general elections. And, of course, you can call in with your reactions to whatever comes out of today. And it's a Central Time favorite with an up-close look at the brown bears at an Alaskan national park featured in one of the best live webcams in nature. A park ranger is going to join the show and answer our questions. Well, my questions anyway. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.